This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies. On Thursday, the federal COVID-19 public health emergency declared by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came to an end. But millions of Americans who contracted the disease continue to suffer from symptoms, many of them debilitating, a condition known as long COVID. Our guest today, James Jackson, is a recognized expert on the cognitive and mental health impacts of long COVID, which he says are quite common. He writes in a new book about people who are happy standouts in their jobs, who after getting COVID are chronically affected by fatigue, cognitive impairment, and depression, or more serious symptoms such as delusions and hallucinations. Jackson's book offers practical advice to patients suffering from long COVID, with suggestions on finding professional help and information on treatments and strategies for dealing with their symptoms. Jackson's knowledge is informed by his work with hundreds of long COVID patients, his previous work with patients suffering from post-intensive care syndrome, and to some extent by his own struggles with obsessive-compulsive disorder. James Jackson is a licensed psychologist specializing in neuropsychology and rehabilitation and a research professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University. He's also director of long-term outcomes at the Critical Illness, Brain Dysfunction, and Survivorship Center at Vanderbilt. He's the author of more than 150 scientific papers. His new book is titled Clearing the Fog, From Surviving to Thriving with Long COVID, A Practical Guide. James Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's really my pleasure to be with you, Dave. Thank you.
So let's talk about long COVID. First of all, how common is it? Do we know how many people suffer from it, either in the United States or worldwide?
There's a range of estimates that people report. In the book, I talk about the number 200 million. That's a huge number of people, and that's an estimate that is widely quoted. I think there's some debate among experts about whether it's more than that, about whether it's less than that.
But that's worldwide, but if, just to be clear. We're not talking
worldwide,
about the country. Right?
Worldwide. And I think the worldwide piece is important because this isn't a United States problem particularly. You know, this is very much a global problem, and indeed – some of the resources that could be used effectively to treat long COVID, those are even less available in some developing countries than in the United States. So that number, 200 million, that's more people than live in the country of Mexico.
And people who get it aren't simply those who spent weeks on a respirator, right? It affects people who had all kinds of experiences with the virus, right?
I think the idea initially was that if you were critically ill in the ICU with COVID, if you were on a ventilator, you would likely have or at least be at risk for these bad outcomes. And certainly you are. Certainly those people are. But I think the thing that surprised many people and the thing that has proved to be true and alarming is that vast numbers of people who were not hugely sick, that is, they had a very mild case of COVID. Some of them report they had almost no symptoms at all. Those are among the people who are profoundly impaired cognitively, from a mental health standpoint, physically. And this is a little bit of a mystery. That is, many people with mild cases are profoundly debilitated, and some people with quite severe cases are doing fairly well. So we're not exactly sure why that is, but it's clear that there's not a relationship, not a robust relationship between severity of COVID and the likelihood of these long COVID symptoms. They cast a long arc in the lives of people who were not very sick.
You have an interesting history in dealing with cognitive effects of illness. And in the 1990s, you and a neuroscientist, Ramona Hopkins, did some research on patients who had suffered from acute respiratory distress and in many cases had spent a lot of time in intensive care units. You looked at the cognitive impact here. Tell us about what you did and what you found.
Mona Hopkins is a preeminent neuroscientist in Utah, and in 1998, she published the very first paper on cognitive outcomes, cognitive impairment in ICU survivors. She studied people with a condition called acute respiratory distress syndrome, and she found, I think in one of the papers, that 78% of people that she studied were cognitively impaired. That was in 1998. In about 2000, the research that I started to engage in began in earnest. We published a paper, I think, in 2003 looking at ICU survivors generally, and we found that between a third and half of those people who had been fairly healthy before, they weren't cognitively impaired, they developed brand new cognitive problems. In subsequent studies and in subsequent years, we have found out that those cognitive impairments ICU survivors have are as similar as we see in people with moderate traumatic brain injuries. In many cases, they're as severe as we see in people with early Alzheimer's disease. So huge numbers of people, lives derailed by cognitive impairment. And this is important because I think these insights about the effects of critical illness certainly informed a lot of my thinking about what might happen following COVID. And unfortunately, things did come to fruition in the way that we feared they might. That is, even people who were not in the ICU have profound cognitive problems.
You know, it was interesting when you wrote about this research that you did, and this was pre-COVID. It was other illnesses that put people in the ICU for periods of time. You asked the patients that you were doing research on whether they had ever been referred to somebody to deal with cognitive issues. What did they tell you?
Yeah, they told us in one voice that that had not been the case. And that was shocking to me and a little hard to believe. But as I consulted my colleagues around the country, they really had the same experience. I think, unfortunately, physicians, thoughtful and well-meaning, excellent clinically, et cetera, they have a certain notion about what constitutes a brain injury. A brain injury is a stroke. A brain injury is, you know, you fall off a ladder and you crack your skull on the driveway. That's too often what is defined as a brain injury. And of course it is. The problem is there are a lot of other ways to get brain injuries. You can be in the ICU on a ventilator. You can have not enough oxygen get to your brain, something called hypoxia. That can be a brain injury. You can be delirious, which is deleterious to your brain. That can cause a brain injury. And you can have long COVID. That too can basically be a cause of a brain injury. So we need to change the paradigm a little bit so that people start appreciating, gosh, you can have this medical pathway to a brain injury, and we need to refer you to cognitive rehabilitation. It's not only that you're in Iraq and you survive an IED explosion. It's not only that you're on the football field and have a concussion. There's a medical route to a brain injury, but no one, almost no one gets referred for rehab. We have to change that.
All right. So in the last few years, you've been seeing a lot of these symptoms from people who had suffered from COVID and had been in intensive care. One of the things you write in the book about this issue of people dealing with long COVID is that they're both battling their illness and the disbelief in the medical establishment. People just haven't made this connection enough, huh?
It's a huge difficulty, and it is fighting a war, if you want to use this metaphor, on both fronts, right? It's fighting a war on both fronts. And that is, you're trying to put out the fire, or at least deal with the fire that is your illness, and you're being battered and buffeted, beaten down by this interaction with healthcare providers who you feel are dismissive of you, who all too often subtly say, you know, have you been to a psychiatrist? You don't have any physical symptoms. Maybe this is all in your head. People are explicit about this, primary care providers, physicians to varying degrees, but the net effect is patients often feel ashamed. They often feel a stigma. They often feel like they're being called lazy, or at least that is implied, that you just need to buck it up, get better, right? So that, along with the reality of these symptoms, makes it a tough challenge for these folks to endure days and weeks and months.
You know, you say that a lot of a high percentage of patients that you deal with say their brains just don't work anymore. But you note that what they're experiencing is different from Alzheimer's or dementia generally. You want to tell us how and what kinds of things they are experiencing?
Yeah, sure. Let's talk about that. So when we think of Alzheimer's disease in particular, we typically think of this drip, 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 this sort of worsening progression that occurs where a year in, you're at a particular place cognitively, 2 years in, that's worse, 3 years in, it's even worse. You're progressing, you're declining. With long COVID and cognitive impairment, in most of our patients, thankfully, we're not seeing this consistent progression, degradation of cognition over time. It's a lot more like a brain injury in that way. And when we think of a brain injury, what we see are really significant cognitive problems, but often they're a little more static. That is, they don't necessarily get worse, and sometimes they get better. So it's probably a little more like a brain injury than it is like Alzheimer's disease. The exception to that is that in older patients who develop COVID and then long COVID, in some of them, they already had a cognitive decline process in play. It was underground, hadn't emerged yet, hadn't really raised its head through the surface yet, but that process was at work. So in those folks, that declining process, we think, is probably accelerated in the context of long COVID, and some people are transitioning more quickly than they otherwise would to dementia or Alzheimer's. It's a concern in our older folks. And our older patients, we refer them to Alzheimer's disease research centers. We get them dementia evaluations. And our younger patients, we're hugely concerned about them. But when they say, hey, doc, I'm 30 years old, I'm 35, I'm 50, do I have Alzheimer's disease? I'm happy that the answer generally is no, you probably don't. Let's check it out, but you probably don't.
Right. So what do they experience? I mean, there are different kinds of impairment. Just briefly, what are the kinds of impairment they are experiencing?
Sure. So the thing that people talk about the most is they talk about memory problems. They often say, oh my gosh, my memory is not working. And memory, I think, is the term that most people know. If you surveyed people and said, hey, list the 9 cognitive domains, let's list 11, you know, let's list cognitive functions. Memory is the thing that everybody would reference, right? So when people say memory, that's what they think they mean. It may not be what they mean. So often they have memory problems, but more typically the problems are with processing speed. That has to do with how quickly you can process information and with attention and with this thorny thing that we call executive functioning. And I say thorny thing because executive functioning is associated with ability to function in so many areas. People with executive dysfunction, problems with function, they have problems driving, they can't manage their money, they have a hard time managing their medication, they can't plan for the future. So executive dysfunction, processing speed, inattention, and some deficits with memory. And if you put it together, because often people have all of that, it's a really toxic cocktail. And what it means for people is they have a hard time functioning in the workplace. They often aren't functioning well socially. They're not reading social cues. They're disinhibited. It's a huge problem at its worst.
Right. And so often many quit their jobs because they just can't perform anymore. And then they lose their income and they lose social relationships and terrible, you know, cascading effects occur. So let's talk about what one can do to try and get better. You know, you say that there are strategies and treatments. Some are restorative, that is to say, they try and help the brain regain some of its functions. But a lot of it is really designed to help patients manage the changes in their brain function, you know, their deficits in ways that improve their lives. What are some of the strategies that help people?
Yeah, I love this question. Back a decade ago, a little more than a decade ago, I spent part of a year in Ely, England, a lovely little town outside of Cambridge, at a cognitive rehab hospital, a very famous one at the time, founded by Barbara Wilson, an eminent neuropsychologist. It was called the Oliver Zangwill Center. And when I went there, the goal was to really learn how to do cognitive rehab. And it was all about compensation. It was about teaching people skills to offset the deficits they had. One big one we worked on was something called goal management training. It's really the best empirically validated. It's the treatment with the best evidence for problems with attention and executive functioning. And when I learned about goal management training, frankly, at the beginning, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is a strategy. How much does a strategy help? And as I looked at the lives of the patients that were being treated at the Oliver Zangwill Center, I quickly changed my tune. I recognized that although this is strategies, it's planning, it's learning to use notes, it's managing your day differently, I realized that if people are integrating that into their lives, so often it is a game changer. And we see that when people get cognitive rehabilitation, not in every case, but reliably, they do better, they get better. That contrasts, that compensatory strategy approach, that contrasts with more of a neuroplasticity-based approach, where the idea is that we are going to engage your brain in a particular specific way, and in so doing, we're going to try to leverage this natural process for growth that is at work. Those are neuroplasticity-based strategies, and often we recommend both of them, compensatory approaches, neuroplasticity-based approaches, and when we wed those together, people often get a lot better.
It's interesting because I imagine a lot of people who are really frustrated that their brains just aren't working as they used to, and you're telling them, hey, you're going to give me lists and post-it notes, but it really is a matter of sort of regular use and ways of thinking, you know, reminding yourself to be thinking about the way you're thinking, and over time and with practice, it actually makes a difference, and people can function in a way they didn't before. They could drive, for example, if they didn't before, or, you know, attend a work meeting and function effectively.
Absolutely. The goal is that these strategies and ways of thinking, that they become integrated, that they become embodied, you know, second nature, if you will. Often, one key thing that happens in the context of those strategies is in the area of problem solving. Where people get derailed often is that they can still solve problems with these brain injuries, but normally it might take them not very long. Now it takes them 5 times as long. Now it takes them 10 times as long. So one of the things that happens is we teach people how to prioritize. We teach people that old saw, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You know, we're going to break some challenging tasks down so that you're not overwhelmed. There are a range of things that we're going to teach you. The people that are the experts in this space are speech and language pathologists. And I would say, you know, may their tribe increase. We need more of them. They are an underrated set of contributors in this long COVID battle. And they've become, many of them, very dear to me because I've seen the way they've improved the lives of our patients.
And are these kind of treatments, the strategizing, because it's, you know, it's not a drug, it's not a surgery, are they covered by insurance typically?
They generally are covered by insurance, I'm happy to say. That piece isn't the challenge so much. The piece is finding these folks who don't necessarily grow on trees. In large and medium-sized cities, you will find SLPs. That's the abbreviation, SLPs. But in rural America and small towns, there are not so many of them. For that reason, we're really thankful for telehealth, which has been a game changer during this pandemic season, because often people are able to get speech and language pathology support virtually, get that cognitive rehab virtually. And in our experience, that still seems to be very helpful.
Okay, so let's talk about the other kind of treatment where you're actually hoping to get the brain better. I mean, to kind of use its regenerative properties to function better. I mean, this is a big subject, but generally, what kinds of treatments are there? How well do they work?
They're often technology-based, so often there are programs that are available either on a computer or an iPad. Sometimes they're proprietary. Some of them are broadly available in the community. You can buy a subscription to a brain training program. It's a complicated topic because there have been a number of bad actors in the last 20 years or so in this space who have noticed, I think, that there's a burgeoning interest in the brain, and they have created programs, things of that sort, charge people a lot of money for them, and there's no evidence of their efficacy. I was a skeptic about this as recently as probably 5 or 6 years ago about the notion that technology-based solutions could improve the brain. But as more and more research emerges, I've become more convinced that this is absolutely an avenue that we need to explore. There are companies grounded in rigorous research. There's a program called Brain HQ that a lot of people engage in. There's a game that is FDA approved that you can play on an iPad, a video game, and it is FDA approved for children and teens with ADD and ADHD. So we think that there are things like that that could be really helpful perhaps to people with cognitive problems in the context of long COVID.
Before we go, I wonder what's happening in terms of research on finding a cure for long COVID. I mean, well, let me ask this. Do we understand the biological mechanisms underlying long COVID, how this virus creates these ongoing problems?
I think it's a really complicated question. And the reason it's a complicated question is because although we've been talking about long COVID as if it's a monolithic thing, as if it's a monolith, there, in fact, are probably many different kinds of long COVID. You know, there's long COVID with primary cognitive problems. There's long COVID primarily driven by fatigue, et cetera. And all of these likely may have some different mechanism. Many of those mechanisms likely have to do with inflammation. They may have to do with clotting. We've got a lot of work that we need to do. That's both in the basic science space. That's in the translational, the clinical space. We need more randomized controlled trials. We were very successful, as you know, at mobilizing our best scientists, our best experts to develop a vaccine in record time. Huge success. I feel like that same urgency, that same commitment to doing something game-changing has too often been absent in the context of long COVID. I think we need that same urgency that we had to develop the vaccine to be aimed at developing long COVID therapeutics. We're making some progress, but I think we've got a long way to go.
Well, James Jackson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Have a lovely day.
James Jackson is a research professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University and director of long-term outcomes at the Critical Illness, Brain Dysfunction, and Survivorship Center at Vanderbilt. His new book is Clearing the Fog, From Surviving to Thriving with Long COVID, A Practical Guide. Al Green is widely considered one of the greatest pop singers ever, known for his soulful ballads. His commercial peak was in the decade of the 1970s. Rock critic Ken Tucker realized recently that this year is the 50th anniversary of what he considers Green's greatest album, Call Me, and he knew he'd have to do a piece to celebrate this rhythm and blues landmark. Here's Ken.
In Al Green's song, Call Me, the singer addresses a woman he's passionately in love with, who, at this moment, is not feeling that same passion. What they once had isn't working for her anymore. Green acknowledges her fading feelings for him, even as he can't resist reminding her of, as he puts it, the beautiful time we had together. What he wants to tell her most of all is that she can call him anytime and he'll be there for her. In Al Green's musical universe, men and women are almost always operating on a level romantic playing field.
The best thing I can do is give you your love, is give you your love, babe. Let you go away, feeling as free as a dove.
Al Green constructed this superb 9-song album for High Records in Memphis at Royal Studios in close collaboration with co-producer Willie Mitchell. Essential to the sound was the high rhythm section, which included the three Hodges brothers, bassist Leroy, Charles on keyboards, and guitarist Teenie Hodges. Howard Grimes played drums. In the 1970s, the warm intimacy of the music that came out of Royal Studios attained an almost mystical force. When I went there to interview Green and Mitchell in 2003, Willie Mitchell yelled at me when I moved my hand to sweep away a spider web in a dusty corner of the studio. "Don't touch it," he said. "It's all part of the sound." I was not at all sure that he was kidding. To Be With Me, one of three hit singles off Call Me, along with Here I Am, Come and Take Me, and the title song. Green's phrasing is unique. He uses a falsetto croon that can deepen into a growl, enunciating lyrics conversationally. Call Me was Green's sixth album and includes two superb covers of country music, Hank Williams' I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, and this one, Willie Nelson's Funny How Time Slips Away.
How am I doing? Well, I guess I'm doing fine. It's been so long, and it seems like it was only yesterday.
This album also includes Jesus Is Waiting, a gorgeous early example of the gospel music that would at one point take over Green's career when he became the Reverend Al Green. And the most underrated song on Call Me is Stand Up, a quietly vehement piece of sinuous funk with politics that imply as much about the importance of black assertiveness as anything that Sly Stone or the Isley Brothers or Marvin Gaye were offering during this same period. That this was the 50th anniversary of Call Me, I had a visceral reaction. I was momentarily overwhelmed, recalling the pleasure that this album has given me over the years.
I can't believe that it's real.
Rock critic Ken Tucker. Al Green's album Call Me was released 50 years ago last month. Terry Gross has our next interview. I'll let her introduce it.
Drivers and passengers, how much time have you wasted circling around and around, searching for a parking spot? Have you nearly gotten killed by someone competing for the same spot? Are you outraged by prices charged by commercial parking garages? Or maybe you live in a suburb that's been paved over for parking lots that are now half empty. My guest Henry Grabar tells the stories behind these familiar problems in his new book, but he also writes about larger issues that you might not be aware of. He describes the book as, in part, the story of how we destroyed our cities in search of more and more available parking, and the people who helped make it so, the mall builders, mobsters, police, and the politicians, the garage magnates, and community groups. There are new alternatives in the works for dealing with traffic and parking. He covers those, too, in his new book, Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. Grabar is a staff writer at Slate who covers housing, transportation, and urban policy. He was the editor of the book, The Future of Transportation. Henry Grabar, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we get into the big issues, can we trade an example or two of what we find most frustrating or weird about parking? I'll start with, in the north, when you dig out a spot for your car so you can drive out after a snowstorm, what people have often done in Philly is put a lawn chair or a trash can or some piece of furniture in the parking spot to reserve it, to say, this is mine. I dug this out and I'm keeping it. And I don't know if that happens in Brooklyn where you live, but where does this tradition start? At first I thought this is just a Philly thing, and now I realize it's not.
I've seen that practice in Chicago, where I lived when I was writing this book. I know it happens in Boston. I believe it happens in Pittsburgh. I think pretty much wherever it snows and there is street parking, there will be claims made on the street. And I think what's interesting about this practice is not only there's the kind of implicit threat of violence that, like, if you were to one of these objects and take the space, that you might be beaten over the head with it, but also that it's defended by politicians. I think when Boston discussed, for example, limiting this practice to 48 hours after a snowfall, meaning you could make a claim, but only for 48 hours, a city councilman said, the issue speaks to the basic principle of what it means to be an American. Like the gold miner and pioneers, residents have a right to stake their claims. And I think you can see the entitlement in the entire American parking picture in that one expression.
Okay, your turn. A frustrating or bizarre issue relating to parking that you've dealt with.
I mean, I just hate not being able to find a parking space. I find, like, the advanced knowledge, the premonition that I will have trouble parking discourages me from driving. And I think about it from the moment I get in the car. How I'm going to be able to leave the car behind when I get out of it. And it stresses me out from the moment I get behind the wheel.
And this is a good moment to mention that your book isn't anti-car, but it's looking for alternatives to the problems that we have. So I have one more I want to mention to you. Parking garages drive me crazy. First of all, they charge a fortune now. And second of all, the way they're designed, like the ramps I particularly hate in the garages where there's like six stories or more, is that sometimes they're really narrow spirals. So you have to drive like super slowly or else you're going to like crash into the wall. And it's almost like dizzying. And then in the parking spot itself, the parking spot is often way too small with a pole on either side. So it is so easy to smash into one of those poles or not be able to open the door because the other car is too close to you.
Yeah, parking garages are, I think, some of Americans' least favorite places. And one thing I learned when I was working on this book was that at the dawn of the auto age, as parking garages become a fixture of American downtowns, there are some city planners and architects who think that parking garages will assume the grandeur of Europe's great or America's great train stations. The idea that parking garages as these sort of transportation destinations will become these kind of centers of activity. And obviously that never came to pass. I think there's this kind of lore in American history of the garage as a place where bad things happen or secretive things, perhaps, like the exchange with Deep Throat that led to the uncovering of the Watergate scandal. I mean, that happened in a parking garage. The bottom line here is that while many people in the parking industry like to think they are in the hospitality business and they're offering a service, the reality is it's a commodity. And the only important thing about a parking space is that it's in front of you when you need it. And so obviously they do try to maximize the amount of cars they can park per square foot. And they're not really that interested in creating a pleasant user experience.
I'm going to just mention one more thing. In Philly, they're very vigilant about ticketing you like a minute after your meter has expired or towing you if you're in a tow-away zone. And you might not even know it because the sign might be covered by trees. So you can't even see it. And if you are towed, your car is taken to the land of junkyards far away from the central part of the city where you've parked. It's really expensive just to get to where your car is. And then you're met with like fee after fee, and it's hundreds of dollars. Is that pretty typical in cities?
I think so. Essentially, parking enforcement serves as a subset of what is now known as revenue-driven policing. And the idea here is that cities take advantage of these parking laws to try and get as much money out of people as possible, but not in the way that you would think, right? I mean, I think this is a common misconception. Meter rates are actually, for the most part, pretty low in most cities, which is to say they are below the market clearing price that would create empty spaces on every block. Most cities make more money from illegal parking fines than they do from meters and garage taxes put together. So, for example, New York City in 2015 made $565 million in parking fines. It's the biggest category of fines that the city issues, but they made just $200 million from parking meters. So what's essentially being run here, and I don't know if cities are conscious of this, is a system that is poorly designed that almost seems like the incentives are in favor of illegal parking, because for the city, that's where they make their money. And I think you see this also in you know, with deliveries, like a truck making deliveries, often double parks can rack up in New York or in Boston, like tens of thousands of dollars in fines every year. And you could ask, well, maybe the city should create delivery zones in which a truck could pull in and park and make that delivery without blocking traffic. But then you realize the city makes a lot of money from illegal parking fines. So this status quo in which it's very challenging to find parking and it results in all these fines and sort of complicated processes to get your car back, this to some extent works to the city budget's advantage, unfortunately.
One of the main points of your book is that parking has determined the landscape of cities and suburbs. And that might seem obvious, but it might not to our listeners. So I want you to explain what you mean by that.
Sure. So when I think about parking's effect on the landscape, one of the things that I'm thinking about are the laws that were passed in the 1950s and 60s in this country that require that every type of building have a certain number of parking spaces. So if you look into the code of your city or suburb, you will likely find a table like this. And it will be very, very long. And it will have almost every conceivable land use you can imagine, from the obvious ones like apartments and offices to ones that seem exceedingly specific, like a dirty bookstore or a nunnery or a tennis court. And for everyone, there's a requirement of a certain number of parking spaces. Now, when you remember that a parking space takes up about 300 square feet, if you're going to require 10, 20, 1,000 parking spaces with these various uses, you are ensuring that perhaps half your property now is consumed with parking. And you see this when you drive around and you look at a post-war commercial strip in a suburb, you will notice that the buildings float in the parking lots like these little buoys in the sea. And all that parking is required. I mean, that's the law that is ensuring that those properties tend to be half parking by area. And if you go to a historic downtown, those types of buildings, right, two, three stories they're semi-attached or attached, forming an uninterrupted street wall of storefronts and offices above or perhaps housing, that kind of stuff is simply illegal to build in most places. So there's a reason that we've stopped building things the way we used to, and the reason in large part is parking.
So some of the really nice things about older cities wouldn't be legal now if you're starting from scratch and building?
I think almost every built form that you can imagine from the early 20th century would be illegal to build in most cities today, perhaps because of zoning, but I think more fundamentally because of parking, right? And so I'm talking about things like on the housing front, brownstones, triple-deckers, three-flats, bungalow courts. Every city has its kind of vernacular attached or semi-attached housing that was built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And these are often some of the most beloved parts of cities and some of the most expensive housing at this point. Unfortunately, according to most residential codes in most places, they are now illegal to build. This is also true of office buildings. I mean, something like the Empire State Building, right? If you were to supply the book mandated amount of parking for the Empire State Building today, you would have a surface parking lot stretching over 12 Manhattan blocks. So clearly, you begin to see how some of these older forms become incompatible with the modern demand to ensure a certain number of parking spaces with every property.
Some people are trying to re-envision what city streets might look like if there was less on-the-street parking. And that includes re-envisioning what curbsides would look like. What are some of those visions?
The one that comes first to mind, of course, is what we saw during the pandemic summer in 2020 when people were nervous about eating inside and all the restaurants opened up seating in their parking areas. And for me, that was a revelatory moment because I had become aware over the course of writing this book that there was something weird going on here where urban real estate prices were higher than ever. And yet this space at the curb, this public space, which in some cases was the most valuable land in an American city on a square foot basis, was being given away for nothing, provided you used it for one thing, which was storing your car there all day. And so there's a natural kind of arbitrage going on there. And you see people taking advantage of this going back to the 1960s and 70s. I'm thinking about things like ice cream trucks, taco trucks, like people selling things out of the curb. Like there's this realization that if this space is going to be free, like maybe I should try and take advantage of that and run a little business here. And then in 2020, you see that realization go mainstream with all these restaurants that had previously considered their parking to be an absolute untouchable asset, right? Like, you know, you want to take away parking for a bike lane, they would tell you you had blood on your hands. And then suddenly in 2020, they decide, you know what? Maybe it doesn't need to be parking after all. Maybe it could be restaurant seating. And I think that was a wake-up call for city planners. It was a wake-up call for some of those restaurants themselves. It was also a wake-up call for regular people to see this space through another set of eyes and think, well, you know, maybe it could be something besides curb parking. It's been curb parking for 100 years, so it can be difficult to imagine what might happen at the curb if we were to decide to do something else with it.
What do you think can happen there besides restaurants?
I think one of the most urgent needs for cities is to plant more trees. I think that's something that will help them adapt to climate change, shade the streets, clean the air, and perhaps most importantly, help them deal with these series of increasingly intense rainstorms that we've seen that have brought flooding to many urban neighborhoods. And one of the reasons that the urban flooding problem is so bad is that so much land has been paved over to make way for parking. And so if you begin to take some of those curb spaces and you decide, you know, we're going to use this space to plant greenery that can soak up some of that water, it can catch rainstorms where they fall before they overload the sewer system and flood people's houses. So that to me seems like an obvious possibility. And then perhaps a broader conception of that would just be to say, create more public space. While it is important that we have access at the curb for people who need to drive up and perhaps can't park four or five blocks away for one reason or another, there's an enormous possibility here to create space for people, thinking about like places kids can play, bike lanes, things that would help us reimagine a city in which parking was slightly less important and in which there were more options to get around some other way.
I want to ask you about bike lanes, because I appreciate that there are bike lanes, and I appreciate that a lot of people are bicycling. It's good for the environment. It's good for, parking and traffic. It's easier for the people who are bicycling to get to and from places because they don't need to buy a car, which is so expensive, and so on. At the same time, some bike lanes are just really poorly designed, and it's really unsafe for the bicyclist and often unsafe for the driver. And I mean, for example, whether the bike lane is on the right or the left of the lane or lanes with the car, when you have to turn in the direction of the bike lane, it's really dangerous because, you know, typically when you're driving, there's no traffic on the side that you're turning from. You know, you're in the lane where there's no moving cars to your right. But there might be bicyclists there now. Have you seen like a sensible kind of bike lane?
I'm glad you mentioned that, Terry, because something happened a few days ago in Brooklyn that's been on my mind. A father of two was biking home from a grocery store in Brooklyn, and he was killed by a truck driver turning right across a bike lane. His name was Adam Uster. I've been on that bike lane many times myself. It was, in fact, my route home from work for many years. And I continue to be surprised that cities keep drawing out facilities like this and calling them safe places to bike when they really evidently are not. It is possible to create a safe space for biking where people turning across the bike lane perhaps have to wait for a different signal to make that turn or something like that. I mean, it's not nuclear engineering. It's not rocket science. We can figure this out. There are cities that have built safe bike lanes. New York isn't one of them. And then you come to the question, well, why isn't it one of them? One of the people I talked to in my book lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and he made it his mission to build a bike lane on Central Park West because a girl riding a city bike had been run over and killed by a garbage truck there several years before. And building this bike lane, which happened, by the way, required taking 200 parking spaces. And that became a source of major conflict in the community. In fact, there was a lawsuit filed by a condo board along this route. And to me, that conflict says a lot about our priorities.
Henry Grabar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Henry Grabar spoke with Terry Gross. His new book is called Paved Paradise: How Parking Explains the World. He covers housing, transportation, and urban policy for Slate. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Saman, and Marie Baldonado, Thea Challender, Seth Kelly, and Susan Yakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross and our co-host Tanya Mosley, I'm Dave Davies.